The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world views and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
Well, the last time I made a program, I said the chances of really changing this whole criminal justice system of the revolving door justice we hand out to hardened crooks and criminals are probably two, slim and none. I told listeners at the end of that broadcast, probably by the time you hear the program next time, you'll be able to pick up a newspaper, listen to a news broadcast, and hear of yet some other old, elderly, crippled up little old lady victim who has been attacked, beaten to death, raped, shot by another hardened criminal only a few days out of jail. Well, it happened the next morning. I pick up the Los Angeles Times the following morning after making that program, and here's another story about an ex-convict pleads guilty to murdering an 88-year-old Claremont woman he attacked sexually just 10 days after being released from a prison term for a similar assault on another elderly woman. He'd been sentenced to prison July 11, 1970, on a conviction for rape, sodomy, and burglary. The victim of that attack was a 67-year-old Pomona woman. He choked her, threatened her with a knife. Got out of jail for that offense, and 10 days later killed an 88-year-old woman. Recently in the San Diego Union was an article by a San Diego resident whose name is Coffin. He also happens to be an assistant U.S. attorney. And he commented about how he hoped that certain members of the judiciary and the California Parole Board were enjoying their little joke on the people of the state. I've got to tell you what he said because I think it is really right to the point. He calls it an Alice in Wonderland parole system, like Russian roulette. He said, I refer to the release of convicted murderer Robert Page Anderson, who once again is at large among us poor fools, we who still cling to the thought that our criminal justice system is supposed to operate to protect the victims of crime despite repeated examples to the contrary. Anderson, you will recall, as recently as 1972, was awaiting the death penalty for his cold-blooded execution of a shopkeeper in downtown San Diego. The Supreme Court took care of that, however, by declaring recently the death penalty unconstitutional. And by the way, let me interrupt to mention that also in this same issue of the Los Angeles Times, I read a little blurb about the United States Supreme Court, who just since the last couple days when I've been making these broadcasts about this incredible situation in our country, stayed the execution of three Texas murderers. That was in the paper today, too. At the same time I read about this ex-convict pleading guilty to killing an 88-year-old woman, the Supreme Court stays the execution of three convicted killers. Now, we'll never get the point, but I'm going to talk about it anyway because it's so filling the news right now that it's almost unbelievable. We have been assured that opponents of capital punishment did not mean that people like this Anderson down in San Diego would be free to murder again. Their death penalties would be commuted to life imprisonment. But this San Diego resident goes on to say, well, now let's see what life imprisonment means to the parole board. Anderson is back on the street a little over 10 years after taking the life of another human being in an armed robbery. And he said, lest we think this is but an isolated example of disregard for our welfare, remember Mary Ellen Martinez, the 15-year-old girl who was raped and murdered in Tecolote Canyon by a previously convicted rapist who had just been paroled by our enlightened penologists? And then there was this fellow he wrote to the newspaper named Kemper, the fabled mass murderer from Northern California, who after killing several people was pronounced rehabilitated by a team of psychiatrists, returned to society, and then murdered about a dozen more of us before he was caught again. I remember newspaper accounts, he wrote, of how Kemper, with dismembered bodies of victims in his trunk, would go see a psychiatrist for a therapy session after his release, and the psychiatrist would note in his file how well his patient was progressing. And he had dismembered bits and pieces of bodies in the trunk of his automobile while he's sitting in there talking to his psychiatrist, who is making cute little notes about how well he is doing. Coffin's letter went on to say the proponents of capital punishment are hardly mad dogs lusting after the shedding of blood. They are simply of the opinion that the intentional murdering of a human being is such a tragedy that the state must exact the ultimate sanction in order to deter future murders and to prevent the convicted killer himself from murdering again. Whoever thinks serving 10 years of a life sentence is going to deter the Robert Page Andersons of the world is deluding himself. What to do about this Alice in Wonderland penal system of ours, he asked the paper? Unlike our legislators who enact more lenient criminal laws in the teeth of rising crime waves, I don't profess to have all the answers. All I know is, come election time, I, for one, am going to give the needs of effective law enforcement more than just a passing thought. That may be a little bit of a warning to liberal legislators in various state governmental bodies all around the nation, and it may be a little bit of a warning to those at the national level, in Congress, and even those who sit in the courts of our land. Sooner or later, I think, the American people are going to just about have had enough. Now, as far as I'm concerned, we're way beyond that level right now. We shouldn't be having what we have right now. Incidentally, this morning I was shown an interesting magazine, slick, four-color, thick magazine, about the size of some of the thickest magazines on the stands. This one, totally dedicated to the drug culture. It was something about Get High or the New High or Up High or something like that. The cover showed that this was the special LSD section. And in it, it showed advertisements for everything from incense bowls to these pure silver little holders so you can get the absolute last little bit of a drag off your cigarette to machines for rolling marijuana cigarettes, to even little spyglasses for making sure the white crystals of heroin are pure enough, advertisements about where to get the stuff, how to grow the stuff, poppy seeds for sale. A little scale was advertised which showed that you could then measure the difference between kilos and grams and whatnot, and it said in the ad, if you send off for the scale, it could mean the difference between a felony and just a fine. So it was surely something you would want to have in your possession, being a fanatic of the drug cult. I couldn't believe my eyes. One of the most ultimate obscenities in the American scene. A magazine where I would assume that you would think that there ought to be laws that exist where every individual who put his name in that magazine, every individual advertising one of those products ought to be in jail. But they're not, and they're totally free to advertise where to go to get it, how to buy it. There was another little cute ad about a pocket device that could detect a bugging device if someone else was wearing one. And it said, know who you are dealing with, so that drug addicts who were buying drugs could try to spot the narcs when the police undercover agents were trying to bug the conversation. It's a really cute magazine. Actually, it's a filthy, rotten obscenity. But apparently there's no law against it. Now, why all of this? Well, we know that we're a nation adrift in immorality, in disintegrating social values, the gradual destruction and dismantlement of the American home, the, call it, the callousness of the American conscience, which does not allow feelings of outrage, but a feeling of hopeless resignation, of acceptance to the relationship between violence on TV and the relationship between that and crime, to glorifying the sickness of society, the horror movies, all the rest of it. We just sigh and say, well, I guess that's the way it is. That's the way people live life. I guess it's there, so we probably ought to know about it. So therefore, we are unable to become outraged anymore about the abuses, about what's going on in the world. We tend to glorify how the society in which we live is sick rather than decry that situation. Since the 1950s, the movie and TV industry have gradually accelerated and escalated with their level of sex titillation, bizarre violence, and greedy commercialism until now they just reek with this mad hucksterism of the lustful desire for the buck at the expense of human degradation. And Americans are satisfied with all of this. They don't care if they wallow around in a world of erotic soap operas, porno magazines, X-rated movies, and obscene violence on TV sets, theaters, and corner newsstands. It's all ho-hum. So what? Everybody else is doing it. Why shouldn't we? The producers of the perverse are kind of vying for that ultimate obscenity. You don't know when they're going to achieve it. Maybe finally they will get as bored with it as by now an awful lot of their viewers must have. But meanwhile, what's it doing to us individually and as a nation? An awful lot of millions of people know Gene Shalit, noted critic who is a part of the Today network team on television. He had written the following. How long will America stand for violence or sit for it? Each week, millions sit mesmerized by movies saturated with explicit savagery that is desensitizing our people. Violence that shrivels the soul and numbs the mind. Have you had enough? Do you want to stop it? Or are the Cassandras correct when they say that we're a violent nation? Shalit said several years ago Bonnie and Clyde was memorable because of the scene in which the gangsters were seethed with hundreds of bullets from ambush, their tormented bodies jerking and imploding on the screen. Many audiences staggered away from what was then considered vivid horror, but which is apple pie compared to the movie mayhem that has ensued. In movie terms, the decade that's followed could be better called the Decadence. A film swarming with violence, including riddled bodies, is 2 Minute Warning, Shalit talks about. This sniper in a football stadium story ends with a screaming stampede of trampled fans. The film's director defends its violence. He says, I think it's good. Audiences really get into the action of the movie. They watch the acting out of a lot of aggression, and in that way they get rid of a lot of stuff that might come out in other, more destructive ways. Finally, he cranks out the creaky cliché, the violence in the film and in our society is there. Shalit goes on to say most vile in this violent year was Marathon Man with Laurence Olivier and Dustin Hoffman. The director churns out a plotless barbarity, the evil in order of appearance, a fiery car crash with 2 men burned alive, a bomb in a baby carriage, a throat slit at the opera, a neck snapped in a hotel room, a man stabbed in the stomach, 3 people shot down in a country house, a throat cut on a midtown Manhattan street, another sliced throat, plus 2 fake killings and 2 hideous scenes in which one, the actor, tortures the other with dental tools and a dental drill. In answer, the director trots out the trite tripe, it's a violent world we live in. Shalit said, I do desperately hate the hypocrisy of producers who insist on telling us that it's because violence exists in life and because it's all part of the story, when all of us know full well that it's because they want to hear the sound of money dropping into the box office. He said, I've sat in theaters and heard audiences cheer movie killers. I've seen men and women jump up during Death Wish and shout out their support for the killer. Who are the guilty? And then Gene Shalit really lowers the boom. He really gets, just like some of the films, explicit. He says, Hollywood writers, so creatively bankrupt that they use sleazy violence. Directors who revel in flashier, trashier ways to show horror and pain. The money lenders who only have a sense for dollars. Audiences who deliver the dollars in return for cheap thrills. Actors who accept their exploitation. It's sad to see gifted people sell out to sick shock. Parents who don't care what their children see, who don't bring pressure on local theaters that show this desensitizing trash. Mandarin critics who think it chic to approve of the kinky, the corrupt. Then he said the Motion Picture Association rating board members who wink at debasement and drape a benign R over the what deserves
Marathon Man. They ought to serve as shock absorbers, but they're almost always passed along the shock to the movie public, a large part of which is very young. That's why parents have no reliable guide to the movies and cannot accurately gauge the loathsomeness of a film by its rating. Then Gene Shalit finally concluded, if the movie makers keep up their assault, they may wake up some late morning and discover that a political powerhouse in Washington has mobilized Congress for a last straw vote ready to clamp a tourniquet on Hollywood's bloodiness. Although it's probably very unlikely, because people would claim that would, of course, violate the First Amendment. And you can't do that. If it happens, people say they want to know about it. So the people that are the writers, the money lenders, the producers, directors, and the actors all justify it, because if it floats by in the gutter, of course, you want it on your dinner table. If it gets flushed down the toilet, it belongs on the screen. It's a good thing we don't have plastic stomachs and can't see what goes on there, or possibly we would investigate every turn that some of the food we ate today that looked good on the plate, but I don't even want to think about what it looks like now,
takes as it works its way through our viscera. The war against gore isn't really succeeding very well when you get right down to it. People say there is violence in society, so let's show violence. And they don't seem to know that this breeds more violence, that they're on a vicious merry-go-round where corruption feeds upon corruption, violence creates yet more violence, and those who are responsible cop out by saying other people are doing it. Some movie exhibitors, while conceding that violence sells, are starting to gag about what they show on their own screens. Marvin Goldman, president of the National Association of Theater Owners, says
it's the gratuitous violence that gets me. I can understand that in a war movie, for example. You may have to show a soldier shooting someone, but do you have to see the brains and the intestines flowing out? Exhibitors say there isn't much they can do about it, but that their customers would leave if put on a bland diet.
Well, you know, it's kind of like if that's all there is to see, that's all you see. Kind of like the gal said, that's all you get. That's it. That's it, baby. There ain't no more. I mean, if you're wearing clothes, all there is to see is just, I guess, your face and your hands. If the movies only produced movies that just didn't show all the explicit gore and the cat's liver and the ketchup being thrown against the wall in slow motion, masquerading as the viscera, maybe it's real. I don't know. Maybe they're really killing some of those people. I'm kidding, of course. I hope I am. I understand people have died doing stunts and things like that for movies, but maybe the time is going to come when they will actually do it for real. There was a time several years ago when some person, maddened, insane, stricken with his personal problems as well as those of society, a newscaster in the state of Florida, committed suicide in front of his own viewers. He announced his death. He talked about what was going to happen, pulled out a pistol and shot himself, and the viewers got to watch. Now, I suppose that that is the type of thing that ultimately, if it could be given advance billing, an awful lot of people would like to go to see a real murder. And it seems to me there was something filmed, like there was a weird, sicky, hippie sex movie in which there actually was a death scene, and they filmed this, and it is an undercover film that is available to people that they can actually buy, where they can see, this time, not a faked death, but a real death. I would suggest to those people, go to Entebbe with the book in your pocket called 90 Minutes at Entebbe. Or what you could do, you could go over to Big Dada Idi Amin's Nation, and all you got to do is sit in a bar and say, I really did enjoy the attack by those Israeli commandos. And you'll get to witness a death scene. But this will be your own. They have now confirmed that Idi Amin and his troops strangled to death Mrs. Dora Block. They've also confirmed that a photographer who was told by an informant to go out and photograph her body was himself strangled and then burnt and his body dumped nearby hers. They've also confirmed that a couple of girls sitting at a bar were joking that their boyfriends were about as fast as those Israeli jets, and they were both killed. They've also confirmed that anyone who even mentions the name of Dora Block in the nation of Uganda is going to be murdered by Idi Amin. So you want a death scene, all you got to do is go to some of the nations where you can have it. The firing squads are still busy in Ethiopia. They're killing people every day in Kenya. President Kenyatta of Kenya is very definitely the leading suspect in the assassination of a member of another tribe and a leading critic high in the government who was last seen in the company of some of the state police or the police closest to Kenyatta himself, and in an official car, they later found his body dumped, tied out by a pool with his blood defiling the water where cattle and some of the Maasai, I guess, were known to drink. This time the hyenas didn't eat the body. The other time some of these people had dumped bodies out there in the nation of Kenya, they claimed the hyenas had come and eaten them, but this time they claimed the man was so popular, which he was, tremendously popular, even looked upon as a possible successor for Kenyatta after his death. But because he was saying a little thing here and there critical of the government, he was eliminated. Some people suspect Kenyatta might have had a hand in that. Of course, to you and I, that's not obvious at all. Incidentally, I guess he was bound and gagged, probably shot in the back. Maybe they claimed it was suicide. You never know about some of these governments. But then, if you want to go there, you can see violence, all the violence you want. I was just talking to Mr. Stanley Rader, our vice president for financial affairs, who returned from a trip to South Africa the other day, and he'd been down to Rhodesia. And they'd taken him out to what is called one of the operational areas. and he got to see death, he's probably never going to forget it. 20 bodies lying there on the ground, some of them burnt, the bullet holes, the wounds, obviously visible, and he said you could smell it from way, way far away. That sickening, sweet, sick smell of rotting, decomposing human flesh. Some of them have been dead for days, lying out there in the sun. He actually was there, saw it, photographed the bodies. People want to see this kind of thing. It's unbelievable that these people can justify that kind of a diet. Now, some kind of a widespread revolt by viewers and listeners would change things. Some kind of a widespread revolt by some of the stations and the television outlets that put it on would change things. It's going to have to come from the grassroots. It's going to have to come from a rejection of the people themselves, and especially a refusal to buy the products of those sponsors that advertise that type of thing, before anything's ever going to change, because it's never going to be changed in the courts. The nation, adrift in amorality and immorality, is going to scream to the high heavens that it violates the First Amendment to interfere whatsoever with this unbelievable flow of ultimate obscenity and rotten, filthy gore, murder, rape, arson, and crime on the silver screen. That's interfering with the freedom of speech. If it goes on, if it happens, if it's out there, you ought to be able to watch it. I knew before Richard Speck was ever in jail after he stabbed those 8 nurses in Chicago so many years ago that some characters would go make a movie on it, and they would prolong every single one of the death scenes, so you got to sit there and enjoy these poor, terrified Orientals and others watching the butcher knife descend. It's what people want to wallow in. You talk to the police. Get to know a policeman. Get to know his wife and family. Talk to him as a human being and find out what they say. And mostly they're going to tell you about the inability of the criminal justice system, lenient judges, courts, and laws that cannot keep known criminals off the streets. They say there's not just one culprit. Maybe they make some bad arrests, sure. Maybe they fail to come up with hard evidence or reliable witnesses, yes. They're only able to make arrests usually in about 1 out of 5 serious crimes reported, as a matter of fact. But the police are overworked, overburdened, undermanned, and oftentimes underpaid. And an awful lot of inattention is given to where the real problem is. Favorite targets of public criticism these days are some of the judges. They're accused of being too lenient. Maybe some of them are. In the overall picture, though, really, even there, the judges play a relatively small role, because theirs is the problem of trying to interpret some of these unbelievably wordy laws with thousands of loopholes, and trying to satisfy the legislators. And you'll still find people out here, some of the slobbering, quavering, sob-sister, do-gooder types that just are so dependent upon all our big, vast 10 and 12-year university studies and monumental piles of information that they say do not prove cause and effect relationships between violence and entertainment and crime. And they don't know what they're talking about. You are what you eat. And your mind is what it feeds on. And when your guard is down, and your emotions are being toyed and tampered with, and you're being entertained, and you see nothing but violence, gore, blood, filth, maiming, everything you can imagine from the time you're a little tiny child, and we live in the midst of a TV generation now that is brought up on that type of thing, it's bound to affect your mind. Just as much as when you eat meat and carrots, it becomes a part of your body. When your mind feeds on that kind of filth, it becomes a part of your mind. So your level of control, when you do lose emotional control of yourself, is going to result in some pretty kinky, hideous things. And people who didn't know that they were potential killers had been feeding on murder and rape and arson and violence of all sorts ever since they're little tiny kids sitting around the living room in grotesque positions watching it, whether from the cartoons to the movies. Suddenly, in the midst of some gigantic family argument, there's a knife there, a gun there, and boom, somebody's dead or lying there bleeding to death. They don't know why, but their mind snapped, and their subconscious, the constant feeding into their minds of all this violence, finally caught up with them. They didn't plot it. It wasn't premeditated. A tremendous percentage of murder and homicide in the United States takes place between loved ones, family members, uncles, cousins, brothers, fathers and mothers, children and their parents. a woman and her daughter, a man and his son, two brothers. They take place during Christmas time, at the opening of the presents, in front of Christmas Eve fires, over Thanksgiving turkeys. They take place in automobiles and in front rooms and kitchens and bedrooms of homes. Murder on the street is out there, yes, but the broad majority of homicide takes place between family members. And there is a relationship between violence on television and violence in the movies and crime, and I don't care what kind of a slobbering sob sister says the opposite. You can talk
to police officers, to law enforcement agencies, and the people who really have to deal with all of this rotten mess. Talk to the people that go pick up the dismembered bodies. Talk to the cops who show up at the scene of a crime to find some hideous sex molester slain a little girl and discover in his apartment a great big pile of prurient and pornographic literature.
Talk to the cops who arrive on the scene when some filthy homosexual obscenity walking around like a leering creep in society has perpetrated some bloody slash murder and look at all of the sadomasochistic literature there about discipline, they call it. I've been advocating recently to take a look at a law that was given to a man named Moses whose face was so absolutely glowing that the Israelites were afraid of him because this was a moral, a physical, a carnal law given to a physical, carnal, human society. This was not a great spiritual law that had to do with vague spiritual things. It was a practical, day-to-day physical law that prescribed penalties for various actions, whether it had to do with an animal that was known to be dangerous and you let him get out and hurt somebody, with landmarks, with borders, with inheritances, with paying people a fair wage for their work, or it had to do also with bestiality, with every obscenity you can imagine, with all of the problems of any human society. And that law said, in Exodus 21 and verse 23, you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. It says, for example, in the 22nd chapter of the book of Exodus, that a person is to restore even more than they stole. In some cases, they're to restore up to five times over. They pay double, and so on. If a man steals an ox or a sheep, it says, and kills it or sells it, he is to restore five oxen for one ox and four sheep for a sheep. Let's apply that to an automobile. A man steals a car, and he sells it or he wrecks it, then he is going to give the owner of that vehicle five automobiles. And he's going to have to work to produce that. And his sentence is not served until that has been produced. It says here in verse 2 of chapter 22, if a thief be found breaking up, all right, that's breaking and entering or burglary, and be smitten that he die, there shall no blood be shed for him. How about that kind of a law to protect homeowners? Now, we got it the other way around. You know that, don't you? No, we're never going to drop those measures. I saw in the newspaper just today another one of these horrible crimes, and then I saw that the U.S. Supreme Court had stayed the execution of three more killers.
Till we get the idea that killing someone deserves death,
we're never going to solve the problem of crime. Well, write for this booklet on crime can be stopped. Here's how. Because it shows the cause and the cure of crime. Pick up the telephone and dial a toll-free number, 800-423-4444.
That's 800-423-4444.
Or you can write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. It's absolutely free of charge. Request the current number of the Plain Truth while you're at it. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.